Hello. Happy Halloween, Lex.
Happy Halloween, Duncan. Ooh, we got some treats.
Oh, we got some treats, all right. Hey, should we mix it up a little bit? Why don't you do the intro this time?
Oh, was that a special request from the audience?
There was an audience comment made that I always do the intro. I always hog the intro. So here I am.
Wow.
Generously handing over the reins.
I've got butterflies already. How do I do your job, which is not easy to explain this convoluted premise? Welcome to Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time, the podcast where we select movies to challenge one another to blow each other's mind. That means, let me just break down an example. Okay. Duncan picks a movie for me that I haven't seen. And the hope is that it's so good that it blows my mind. However, this go round, it's a little different. Why?
First off, I'll just probably do the intro next time. I think I'll just go back to doing the intro. Secondly, because we're doing two movies. I've got to pick. We've never done this before.
It's a Halloween doubleheader.
And to see who goes first, I think we're going to do a coin flip. Although I don't have a coin, I do have a movie called Dead Hands Dig Deep that this horror filmmaker gave to me. It's sitting on my desk. I'm going to flip it. You want the front or the back?
I'll take the front. Cover, as they say.
And it is your choice.
Okay. We're going to go with my movie, which is a sequel to a very, very famous horror movie. Iconic, a legendary horror movie. It's called Psycho 2. It is the 1983 sequel to Alfred Hitchcock's Psycho. It came out 22 years after the original, much like Dumb and Dumber 2. I liked Dumb and Dumber 2, but that's for another episode. This Psycho was based on a book by Robert Bloch that was published in 1959. Robert Bloch wrote a sequel to Psycho, Psycho 2, 1 year before Universal decided to make this movie sequel. They are pretty much unrelated. Universal felt a little weird about where Robert Bloch went with Psycho 2, the book. It's a Hollywood satire. This is not a Hollywood satire.
Hollywood does not like Hollywood satires.
No, it does not.
Especially HBO.
They hired Tom Holland, who's probably most famous for the Child's Play series, also Fright Night, a horror writer and director.
A legend. What?
A legend. Yeah, absolutely. Terrific. I'm going to fess up here. I have not seen a Child's Play. Have you?
I'm so glad. I just watched Child's Play for the first time about a month ago. I'd never seen it. I'm a big Brad Dourif fan.
I knew that was coming.
But, you know, he's not in it a ton. But I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it.
That's awesome.
Now, I hope this isn't a problem. Do I need to have seen Psycho to see Psycho 2?
Wait, you haven't seen Psycho?
I'm just busting your balls, buddy. I'm just busting your balls. I mean, I could have just watched Gus Van Sant's Psycho.
Oh, Jesus. Have you watched that recently?
Recently. I saw it once. That was enough.
Yeah, that is.
I saw it once and it felt like I'd seen it twice.
That's a weird tangent, by the way, is Vince Vaughn's career post-Swingers in the drama block. What was going on there? Do you have opinions?
I think Vince Vaughn is a really, obviously, totally hilarious and a really interesting leading man. It felt like at that stage he was kind of trying a lot of different things. He's a big boy, so he was trying some kind of threatening roles, some darker roles. I mean, I thought he was pretty good. I think the weird thing for me about Gus Van Sant's Psycho is I believe there's only, 30, 40 seconds of new footage that deviates. Yeah,
it was supposed to be shot by shot, right?
Shot remake. So there's a little, a couple little dream sequence moments, and then there's a little bit of Vince Vaughn jacking off. And it just seems crazy to me that Gus Van Sant was like, hold on a second. I've got to remake Psycho. You know what this movie really needs? Six or seven. Everything's going to be the same. I just want one shot of Vince Vaughn lightly jacking off.
And I feel like having watched Anthony Perkins in Psycho 2 this go round, I'm not sure that Norman would be a masturbator. I feel like that's probably what drove him to kill.
I thought you were going to go for Norman Bates' masturbating pun there. Was that, did you kind of bail on it halfway through?
No, I actually didn't think of it. I'm not as quick as you, Duncan.
Okay. All right.
So Anthony Perkins was resistant to doing a sequel to Psycho. However, the Tom Holland script was exciting enough to him that he signed on.
Well, it wasn't on my mind before the... It occurred to a couple of guys who wrote an more or less unsolicited script called The Return of Norman Bates. And I think the success with which they wrote that script and the interest that they were able to get from the world press was instrumental in encouraging Universal to make their own version. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's the book, Psycho 2, which has nothing to do with
exactly.
If they had not gotten Perkins back in as Norman Bates, they were considering Christopher Walken, which would have been interesting. I'm glad they got Perkins back. They also were considering Jamie Lee Curtis for the role that eventually went to Meg Tilly, and obviously that would have been appropriate given Janet Leigh being the big kill in Psycho, and how the story from Psycho 2 is tied to Psycho. But we have Meg Tilly. Feelings about Meg Tilly, Duncan?
I have a few, as I have many about Tony Perkins, who I'm just such a big fan for. A lot of people forget he was a real heartthrob before Psycho. He's a handsome man. He's a little bit of an odd duck. He's like a human scarecrow. He is so damn tall and bony. I just want to strap him down and feed him. Meg Tilly, you know. You can tell a lot by a person by who their favorite big chill character is. And my favorite has always been Meg Tilly. She is so crushable. She's a huge, huge crush of mine. She's incredibly crushable in this movie. She almost feels like she's the love child of like Bjork and Audrey Hepburn.
I like it.
I didn't know till a couple of years ago that she and Jennifer Tilly were sisters. That never occurred to me. They feel so different. Am I dense that I didn't know that?
Okay. Yeah. Now you seem dumb, but where I didn't catch on to the Bates masturbation pun. Now,
well, why would I'm ahead of you. I've known that. I mean, have they been in a movie together? I'm sure they have, but
I don't think so.
Okay. Well, I mean, she's very soft spoken and Jennifer Tilly's kind of big and brassy.
Hey, that's that sister, that classic sister dynamic.
Anyway, I'm a huge fan, and I loved her in this.
I think she's fantastic in this. I think Anthony Perkins is so watchable in this. Also, I just want to see him in more. I really don't, other than what's the movie I saw with you? Joan Didion.
Play It As It Lays.
Play It As It Lays, where he is fantastic. I can't think of another movie that I've seen with him, and I'm hungry for it.
Oh my! Well, I'll send you some recommendations. He is amazing in Catch 22. He's Chaplin Tatman. Fantastic. I watched him not too long ago in Remember My Name, which is a very good Alan Rudolph almost like a twisted noir thriller.
Cool.
Yeah, Murder on the Orient Express.
We've talked about Crimes of Passion. Neither one of us have seen that. I want to see that.
Oh, I like that you just assume I haven't watched Crimes of Passion in the past 2 weeks. Right, I have not seen that. But I'm a big fan. I'm always happy when Anthony Perkins shows up in a movie.
Speaking of big fans, I am a big fan of who they decided to have direct this movie. Richard Franklin, Australian director. We've brought him up before, I think, in the Ricochet episode, probably in the Hitcher episode. He directed Road Games with Stacey Keach and Jamie Lee Curtis. He's from the very start worn his love for Hitchcock on his sleeve. I would think, you know, if Universal couldn't get Brian De Palma, then they get Richard Franklin, and it pays off with this movie. It embraces a true love of Hitchcock. I feel like it honors the original going into it. And we've got Dean Cundey, who was the DP for Carpenter and Spielberg, among others. It's a great looking movie. It came out in 83. As I said, it was number two behind Return of the Jedi. So it did well at the BO.
It did well. A lot of competition that year. And I like that this movie starts off black and white. You almost feel like you're in the original Psycho.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not trying to reinvent the wheel.
I feel like it's Janet Leigh. So that's the scene from the original movie, as far as I know. I don't know about that transition shot when it goes over to the bedside table. I haven't seen Psycho recently enough, but there is a transition from black and white to color as we see the credits roll over the famous house. The house looks great. The hotel, I would think, if you know, if Psycho scared you as a kid, and then you get to see that world, which they honor with set dressing, I think original props, all the stuff, they bring it to life, and now you're seeing that world in color. That's got to be pretty engaging, I would think, for the audience.
Yes, I remember. I am such a big fan of the Psycho House. There was no greater thrill for young Duncan when he first came to LA as a child than seeing the Psycho House on the Universal tour. Jaws was great, but seeing that house up on the hill, wondering, can you go inside? How big is it? Oh, I was dying to just jump off the tram and run up there.
Do they let you? I can't remember. You get to see it from a distance. Run up
there? Hell no. Hell no, you're kept at a distance.
What do you have memories of being scared about Psycho at all?
I watched it with babysitter on video. I was scared, but it had been talked up so much by my parents.
Right.
I think my mother, you know, had told me about people, you know, passing out in the theater and running out in fear. I was so braced for it that I really wasn't that scared. I think the black and white provided some distance. I don't know what else I'd seen that had been that violent, but the shower scene, I think because I was just expecting the worst, was not as terrifying as I would have thought.
Yeah, I agree. I kind of had the same experience. It was not scary, and my memory doesn't live large as a movie that I cherish in a big way, but this movie has made me really want to sort of invest in the world of Norman Bates. Maybe go back to Psycho. There were two sequels after this, one of which Anthony Perkins directed. He directed Psycho 3. There's this Bates Motel series. I don't know. Maybe I'll watch that. I kind of like what we learn about Norman Bates in this movie that Richard Franklin and Tom Holland reveal to us.
You yourself have said that one of the interesting parts of Norman now, 23 years later, is that he knows he's dangerous. Mm-hmm. He knows his potentials. This does enrich the character, does it not?
Yes, it makes it a little bit sadder, actually. And I think that that sadness is in a strange and rather beautiful way, is repeated in the musical score. The musical score, of course, of the first Psycho is very jarring and extremely full of constant, a sort of dissonant uneasiness about it. But the score of Psycho 2 is very melodic and yes, rather wistful.
Did you, like Norman Bates, feel some mixed emotions as you came up those stairs to the set of that big house for the first time after so many years? Does it seem like an odd kind of home for you after all of this time?
It seems very much like home, but not an odd home.
The credit sequence is scored. We've got the score by Jerry Goldsmith, which is terrific, instead of Bernard Herrmann. And then we've got some names in the cast here. Did that excite you in any way, some of those names?
Oh, I think you know they did. So, sure, I guess it sounds like if Paramount couldn't have gotten Brian De Palma, they were like, well, at least we can dig up Dennis Franz. Not dig up Dennis Franz, but bring in Dennis Franz for a little you know.
Oh, yeah.
Sprinkle of De Palma.
A sprinkle of De Palma.
Dennis Franz is now running the Bates Motel while Norman is doing hard time in the stone cold hotel.
Well, this town, if it isn't the parents, it's the kids. I caught a couple of them screwing in the basement of your house up there last week. Of course, I threw them right out. Can you believe that?
What kind of a motel are you running here?
The kind that makes money. People come here to party. They stay a few hours and then they leave. What more are you going to ask from a motel so far from the beaten track, huh?
You're fired.
Hey, you can't fire me. I was hired by the hospital board.
The state has no claim on me or my property anymore, and neither do you. I want you out of here tomorrow.
Yeah, well, why don't you try putting me out, Mr. Wacko? I'd like to see that.
I won't have to. I'll just go to the police. I'm sure they'd be very interested in what's been going on here, especially the drugs. Tomorrow, Mr. Toomey, and don't rent out any more rooms in this motel. No more.
And then you know that I love who his probation officer is.
Yeah, his doctor / probation officer is Robert Loggia. And I would say playing against type a little bit. You do not get Loggia going full Loggia in this. However, I think it actually works for the story. I don't think we're going to have enough time to get into the twists and turns of Psycho 2. But what I will say about this movie is, at least for me, it kept me guessing until the very end. There are reveals which are along the way. They don't hold back, and so therefore it gets sort of incorporated into the story. Things that you thought that they might hold back, they go ahead and reveal, which keeps you guessing as far as what is actually going on in this movie. I think the basic premise is that Norman Bates is released from prison, and he has been declared sane. And someone is doing their damnedest to unravel that sanity and make him go psycho again. It's just so solid as far as a psycho premise goes for me.
How did that get in there?
After I killed that kid in the cellar, I used it to clean up the mess, and then I flushed it down there.
You didn't kill anybody. You were locked in the attic.
It wasn't locked. You said so yourself.
Norman, stop talking nonsense. I tell you, you didn't kill anybody.
Then how do you explain this? Well?
I can't.
Did you clean up the cellar the way you told the sheriff?
No.
Somebody did. And with that towel. after they killed that kid.
Norman, it couldn't have been you.
How can you be so sure? Even I don't know. I always used to black out when
because
I...
Because you couldn't... You don't have it in you, not anymore.
Because Anthony Perkins is so engaging and knows this character so deeply and then has the opportunity to play him again, you actually begin to believe in him, believe his story, and then wonder if the rest of the world is crazy.
Sorry, I'm just still hung up on Robert Loggia as his doctor slash... It's not his probation officer, you're right. It's his,
it's his doctor.
But he's got a great line where he's leaving Norman Bates at the motel and says something like, you know, if you get panicked or, you know, you want to stay calm, just call me. And it's just like, if your lifeline to sanity and being calm is Robert Loggia, you know you are in trouble.
It's got calcium.
Then I'm not drinking it.
Oh, no, it's sweet. You'll like it.
I don't believe you.
Well, then who would you believe?
I don't know, Robert Loggia. Whoa, Robert Loggia.
Billy, your mother's right. New Minute Maid orange tangerine tastes great. It's got as much calcium as milk.
If you say so, Mr. Loggia.
Yeah.
This is great.
Enjoy your breakfast.
New Minute Maid orange tangerine with calcium.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of nostalgia and feelings I have for this character, Norman Bates, watching this movie. He's such a great character, and the movie does do a good job of keeping you guessing of, you know, what is going on and who is behind this new wave of murders at the Bates Hotel. And, you know, you're really rooting for Norman. He's such a underdog.
And he's so fragile.
He's so fragile. And you don't really know how stilted or stunted, I guess, stunted his sexuality is.
Right.
You know, and I remember that from Psycho as well. Is he trying to make the moves on Janet Leigh in Psycho slash
exactly.
Meg Tilly in this movie, and then his sociopathic behavior then kicks in when his adult sexuality is taking over? Or is it more of a chaste friendship, especially in this movie? It kind of goes back and forth, and it does seem like Anthony Perkins and Meg Tilly are becoming friends in this movie. I mean, there's a moment where he brings her back to the motel. She and he are working together at the Greasy Spoon Diner. And she's been dumped by her boyfriend. He brings her back to the motel. And you're like, oh, boy, she's going to think he's putting the moves on her. What's going on? He gets her to stay by playing the I'm scared card. He's too scared to stay after getting out of prison in the old murder motel alone. And she, I don't know, that works for her. She goes for
it. And it works for me. I mean, I feel like I love watching. I really don't know where this relationship is going. But it develops, and there's sort of a beautiful awkwardness in Perkins' performance. Again, once I think I know what his motivation is, it flips. There are elements, I mean, pretty right off the bat, Norman is hearing the voice of his mother. So as an, you know, as the audience, I'm sort of grappling with that. Is he stable? Can he keep the demon at bay? And then I don't know if Jamie Lee Curtis would have worked for this, like Meg Tilly does. The complementary element of her in this relationship is so key to how this all develops, and her being believable and being sensitive, invested in him, a real friend. And it isn't, it flirts with being sexual, but it never quite is. It feels like genuinely platonic. So that really works for it. I don't know. I just thought the two of them together.
You smell good.
I do.
Yeah.
What do I smell?
You smell like the toasted cheese sandwiches.
What?
And my mother used to bring me when I was in bed with a temperature. She used to do lots of nice things for me before she went, before she became.
Shh. Just remember the good things she did for you. Only the good things.
I can't. They're not there anymore.
Of course they're there.
No, the doctors took them all away. Along with everything else. Except those sandwiches.
Shh. Just sleep, Norman.
You believe a lot of what she goes along with yeah. Norman Bates, whereas
which you have to
in a way that work. Doesn't make her character seem dumb, especially with some reveals later on. But right. she does feel, yeah, she has a great quality of this guilelessness that feels like it really works. I should say also, I really liked, it was great that Vera Miles is back as the, I believe the sister, and she's great. So that adds a patina of class to the proceedings yeah. as well.
And it, again, it
no looks one spared for the original cast.
That's right. This is the Robert Mitchum, Gregory Peck of Psycho 2. It looks great. Like I said, Franklin is flexing his moves. There's one scene where Norman is locked in the attic, and we transition from that attic window, which looks wonderful, down to a scene that's happening in the basement below. We get these bird's eye view shots that really open up the scope of this movie. It doesn't feel cheap at all. It really does feel like kind of a prestige sequel and a Hollywood movie in that way, which, you know, because we grew up with the sequels, which became increasingly cheap looking and sort of straight to video, my assumption was always that after Psycho, it just drops and it's just trash. But instead, for me, that's not what this movie is. This is a real love letter to Hitchcock and to the character of Norman Bates. Once we get past the midpoint, things really start to pick up with the turns and the reveals. And it's probably, I mean, I don't even know if it's worth us getting into it, because it's changing rapidly enough that it's engaging and satisfying, and we're getting the kills that we want.
I know Dennis, you want those kills.
Dennis Franz is getting it in a great way. We've got a shower scene. So Franklin is delivering on the what people want from a Psycho sequel. But it's thoughtful too.
I like the sheriff character. I don't want to get into the twist and
turn. He's in part three, by the way.
He's fantastic. But there is one set of murders that I was confused about.
The teen?
Yeah, the teens.
Who kills the team?
We don't
need
to get into this, because I don't want this to be another grenade situation like in the Ricochet episode.
Uh-oh.
People are texting
it's
me.
It's still in your craw? That pin is still in your craw?
So it sounds like, obviously, you're in the bank for Psycho 2. I am not going to give you my full answer on how much I enjoyed it or didn't enjoy it, but I certainly will let you know that it was a lot of fun to check back into the Bates Motel and see my old friend Norman Bates.
Yeah, fun fact was that the final pages were kept secret until the very end for those involved in the movie. So I think that is a testament to just how well this story works, where you're really trying to put the pieces together until the very end, which is really fun. And then also at the end, you get this iconic image of Norman Bates outside of that Psycho house, and it looks fantastic. So I guess we're moving on to Duncan's pick, which is, there are some thematic elements that carry over here.
There certainly are, not only between these two movies, but also with this movie and a lot of movies we've talked about previously. So my movie is 1970s The Honeymoon Killers. Very tough to pick a horror film that Lex hasn't seen for this special Halloween episode. And I can see you already shaking your head and clucking your tongue that maybe this isn't a classic horror in the traditional sense. Maybe it's a little darker, maybe not quite as fun as Psycho 2, but I am just such a fan of The Honeymoon Killers. And you know, when we were talking about Anthony Perkins' oeuvre, I'm reminded of a movie that reminds me of this movie, Pretty Poison, with Anthony Perkins and Tuesday Weld. Some was shot in the same town that some of the Honeymoon Killer scenes were shot in. Pretty Poison is another great story of some wacky kids going on a killing spree.
Perkins and Tuesday Weld were in Play It As It Lays together, right?
Yes, yes.
Oh, didn't know that was a reunion.
It all comes around. So The Honeymoon Killers, Lex, here's a fun fact that I know you know, and everybody knows it. Did you know that Martin Scorsese, our good friend from the pod, was the original director of this film?
I saw that, and that he got fired. He got shit canned.
Famously fired. So this movie, I should say, based on a true story of the Honeymoon Killers, who poisoned, bludgeoned, smothered, drowned, strangled a number of victims, some say up to 20, in the 50s, even though they were only convicted, I believe it was for just one murder that's depicted in the movie. But based on a true story, it's a very independent movie, super low budget. And at one point, the producer, I believe they started with $150,000. The producer, who brought in, it was his roommate at the time, Leonard Castle, who was not a writer. He's a composer, to come in and go down to the courthouse and do some real research and get the transcripts of the case, the trial, and you know, do some real research and come up with a script for this movie, because they didn't really have a lot of money to get a more experienced screenwriter, which I just think is wild because the script is so great.
I'm fascinated by, so after I watched the movie, I went right in to find out about the actual crimes. And of course that's neatly summed up for me on Wikipedia, and it's fascinating. And obviously they took some really key elements from those murders, and we see them happen in the movie, which part of what floors me about this movie is the realistic detail, the choice to really live in the moments that are documented, but they are not portrayed in a splashy exploitation way. Rather, they're very disturbing. But it's interesting to me, going back to the writing aspect, that you know, in 1969 or 68, when they had to pull the script together for this, that would require so much, you know, absorption of court documents and all that stuff to really get into this, because it, you know, again, going back and reading what actually happened and then thinking about this movie, they do a pretty damn good job of telling that story.
Yeah. And Leonard Castle says that in a way he felt almost like he was playing God as the writer, because the two principals were no longer alive. They both received the electric chair. Obviously the victims are not alive. So there's not a lot of people. He's not working with a big budget, so he's not like traveling all over the country to interview cops and things like that. And the cases, you know, this did happen 10, 11 years before. So really he's taking these court transcripts and newspaper articles and filling in the blanks and kind of creating whole cloth these scenes that he wasn't there for. So in, I think in some ways, you know, there's a lot that is in the movie that is accurate, and there's also a lot that is fabricated in a way that I feel like works in terms of a lot of the victims and their personalities. You know, a lot of those personality traits are concocted by Leonard Castle. One of the biggest changes is character played by Shirley Stoller, Martha, had two children. And she initially was touting the children around at the beginning of this whole con and ruse when she met up with the Tony LoBianca character, and they started this murder spree. And then she ended up leaving the children, I think, at a Salvation Army. So yeah. They didn't have children. Kids are expensive. So instead, they have the mom character that she abandons after the first act of the movie.
Oh, right.
Which I think
which works. That's probably a good substitute to kind of get. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I could imagine the version where you show the kids. It's a brutal entryway into buying into their relationship, but you know, it's pretty messed up and demented from the start. However, you're kind of, from an audience standpoint, okay with letting go of the old mother. She accounts for it by having a nurse, a live-in nurse, to deal with that. I will say that, I wasn't able to sort of to pinpoint this watching it, but when you talk about the writer filling in the gaps for what he may not have been able to understand about this relationship is there's a lot of escalation that has to happen in the first half, and understanding what the connection is between these two and how they're buying in to each other. It works and then it doesn't work. And sometimes it's a lot to accept until the momentum, for me, until the momentum gets going right about midpoint, and there's a point of no return. Because I guess maybe he was trying to live up or to be accurate about some of this stuff. There are choices that are made that are hard to justify in whatever 45 minutes. And so it feels like, okay, all right, I'm just supposed to buy this. Okay, fine.
Well, I feel like not having her have kids was the right choice, because there's something about her character that seems so lonely.
Yeah.
That I am very invested in her. So I just want to also say that Castle says he'd never written a screenplay. He'd never read a screenplay before. So he boned up by reading some Pasolini, some Truffaut, and some Fellini to educate himself, which I love that. Imagine anyone reading scripts by those three filmmakers. That's a recipe for making zero money.
She looks like she's out of a Fellini movie, that's for sure.
She certainly does.
You reminded me that the opener, I mean, as far as the acting goes, especially for her, the way she plays her work life versus her home life, the contrast there as we shift gears in the first 5 minutes, work then to home, and how different she is, and then how she presents with other people versus how she is at home when she's relaxing, like told me everything about the character and was like amazing to watch.
The acting is just so good. So these are both mostly theater people. Tony LaBianco, who you might know later from Roy Scheider movie. Scheider movie, The Seven.
Seven Ups.
Seven Ups.
And he's in God Told Me To.
He's in God Told Me To.
Have you seen that?
I have not. The Larry Cohen movie.
Oh my God. That is a doozy. And it has our buddy from Scarecrow, Richard, who's the guy?
Richard, the
guy with the rapist in Scarecrow. Anyway,
I'll tell you in 2 seconds because I'm looking to look at the Didn't I Blow Your Mind This Time Instagram
feed. Hot plug.
All out. Richard Lynch.
Yep.
I think the acting in this movie is fantastic. Shirley Stoller and both Tony LaBianco had done a lot of theater back in the day, especially Tony LaBianco was kind of hanging out with a lot of 70s stars that you might find more recognizable
in
his New York theater life. Marilyn Criss, who comes in and she plays the Southern meets her demise on the bus.
She calls it a toupee.
She's British. She really wanted
really?
The role. Yes, she's fantastic.
She's wonderful.
She really wanted the role of Martha, chunked herself up,
is that what they say these days?
In her mouth and
chunked herself up, huh?
Chunked herself up, put on a lot of coats, tried to get the role. They said, you're just not heavy set enough for who this woman needs to be. And Marilyn Criss was really the one who said, then you need to meet Shirley Stoller. I just think Shirley Stoller is fantastic. I think they're both great. And Tony LaBianco was not old enough for the part. And also they wanted a person of Spanish descent, and he came in and did the accent, dazzled everybody with that. So many of his lines that just have me cracking up. There is some humor in this movie, some real gallows humor, despite the dark, dark, dark subject matter. But right off the bat, we are in a movie that we know is pretty low budget. You see an ambulance go by with like the sign of the hospital on it. It looks like it's just been like slapped on in cardboard. We are in indie movie land. It's black and white. It looks like a newsreel. This should be time-wise around 1949, but really the whole movie kind of just looks like late 50s. There's not really a budget to play into the period.
I really liked that look and feel. In fact, you know what I wrote down there, Duncan? I wrote down, before we got to any murders, I was like, this is like George Romero's Three's Company with the betting arrangements. The southern scene in particular is when it really the sleeping arrangements become absurd. I'm like, what is this situation where the guy gets his own room and the two women who have never met each other before are sharing a bed? I'm like, what is that? And then it quickly boils over and he's like, what am I gonna do?
I was just thinking about your brother and how handsome he looked in that toupee I gave him. He lied to you.
I don't believe it. He never lies to me.
I think he's a little bit afraid of you. It's probably why he never married before.
I bet I'm gonna have to show him what to do.
You must think you're an authority.
Well, I am pregnant.
Not only are you pregnant, you are disgusting. You're the hottest bitch I've ever seen.
And I don't have to take that from you. And let me tell you something. I'm in love with your brother. And if we decide to make a go of this match, which I think we'll do, and sooner than you think, we get out of here before you can say Jack Robinson, we will go to Little Rock. But as a matter of fact, I will make all the arrangements on the phone with my papa tomorrow. Charles will fit right in with us. He has style. And you can go right back to that hospital of yours where you can boss everybody around. Now I'm going back to my husband.
But we should say that though, just the premise of the movie, which is the premise of also the real life crimes, is that Martha is a nurse, I believe, in Mobile, and her good friend Bunny signs her up for the Lonely Hearts Club.
And who is she, Bunny? Do you recognize her?
No.
She's the mom from Everybody Loves Raymond.
Oh, I never really watched that.
You never watched that show?
I watched a little bit. I like Peter.
Yeah, Paul. You did.
Okay. Okay. So signs are up. Now, Lex, this is before Tinder, my friend. This is before Hinge, before Raya. And I love how this movie, it's such
a spot of a time
when being single, it just meant you were a freak, sadly, right. Especially in this patriarchal world, especially for women of a certain age. So she is signed up for this Lonely Hearts Club, this epistolatory letter writing club, and Ray Fernandez, played by Tony, who we mentioned, is fancies himself a real playboy who is preying on lonely women for their money. And another change, kind of a big one, but totally understandable for the script, was that it is thought that he had already committed one murder before he ever met Martha.
Yeah, the guy in real life had a chunk of something fall on his head, and that's how supposedly his murderous tendencies began. Something he got brain damage.
Yeah, and you can see that scar they put on his forehead in a lot of the scenes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I didn't notice that. Attention is
paid to detail. Oh. So these two go on this romance and con spree that often ends up in murder. And there's just something so obviously horrible about it, but completely garish, but also completely compelling in that they are posing as brother and sister going to visit these lonely women. And he's making a play for marrying them in order to get their money. And you're watching the movie wondering, okay, is he going to now sleep with this woman who's his mark and risk infuriating Martha to the point where she boils over and, you know, murders the woman or murders both of them? Or is he going to, he's also always got his hands all over Martha as they're like slipping off to the basement and other rooms in the house.
Yeah.
And risking being discovered by the woman who's the mark who thinks they're siblings. So there's just all types of seedy tension in this movie.
Yeah, and I mean, to be honest, if they didn't slap the exploitation title on it and the intro card, this is based on a true story. If we were just watching a story about two very flawed people into each other for all the wrong reasons, it really does not get murderous until the last third of the movie, and yet it's still really engaging, and you don't necessarily know that murder is within them. I mean, to the point that when Myrtle, the Southern woman, dies on the bus from an overdose of sleeping pills, that he doesn't even know that he's killed her. In this story, by the way, that performance is incredible when she is flailing around and saying, I don't feel good on the pills, like that. That's an incredible performance. But and even when the first murder actually happens, there are only three, I think.
Yeah.
He does not want to do it. He's compelled to do it. She's the one who's pushing it. It feels pretty organic based on their toxic relationship. And it's believable. Based on who these characters are, that this happens this way, but you're not dealing with two murderous maniacs per se.
Right. Different things transpire and go wrong, as they often do in these little con jobs with these women that end up resulting in murder. And mostly it ends up being Martha's hurt feelings and her just insane jealousy.
Can we talk about the scene when she's so upset that she goes swimming and then nearly drowns and flails around in the water like a kid in a kiddie pool? And like, that's when their passion is truly revealed for one another. And at that point, the third mark is observing this. She's more of a woman with
Tanglewood tickets in Western Mass.
That's right. High society. And she's terrific too. But she gets to observe these two being absolutely bonkers together in the water. It's wild.
It's amazing as the camera pans over to her, the look of horror on her face when the man she thought she might be marrying is now canoodling with what she thinks is his
sister.
But yes, that scene in the lake is so good. That's one of three sequences that Scorsese shot part of that. I think he shot.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's a little under dispute what he shot and what he didn't, but certainly him filming part of her in the water, not the whole sequence, but part of that her in the water sequence was him.
Oh, wow.
And it's Leonard Castle did such an amazing job writing this movie, directing this movie. So I should say after Scorsese left, after I believe it was 10 days of shooting, which seems like it would have been a lot, he leaves. Then I believe it's the co-editor steps in. That doesn't work. Then Leonard Castle steps in. He directs it. If you watch the little interview he has on one of the Criterion DVDs, he points to different elements in the script where he's like, yeah, no, listen, I've that scene where we're going to do a close-up of her eyes before the murder, like that's all in the script. He's pointing out different things in the script that he really highlighted, I think probably because he's had plenty of people kind of question the veracity of his direction in this movie, maybe I would imagine, and pointing to maybe giving certain other people credit. But he does an amazing job. He's kind of this one hit wonder in the annals of cinema. And you wonder what he would have done if he had directed another movie, because he had a bunch of scripts and he just couldn't get the funding. His little joke is, I never directed a terrible movie. I never directed a bad movie.
Wow. I love it. How did you see this for the first time? You're talking about the DVD, you say? Is that a disc?
A DVD is a disc. Is a disc. I think I'd seen the poster art, if you've ever seen it, is quite striking.
Okay.
Some of the posters, there's like a bright pink background.
Yeah, yeah.
He's sitting on a trunk with a hand coming out of the trunk. I mean, it really leans into the dark comedy and the exploitation. So I think it might have been something about either that or the fact that Scorsese had some involvement might have
Okay.
a couple of years ago. I should also say the original title was Dear Martha, and Leonard Castle hated the title, The Honeymoon Killers.
Yeah. I mean, I could buy it based on what I was saying before. Like, if you laid off the exploitation title, which it really sounds like, it might create a different tone as you start this movie up. But I mean, I get why it's called The Honeymoon Killers. The woman who plays Janet is phenomenal.
Anna
Q. I had no idea I was in store for that.
That's
I love it.
Cringe-worthy catchphrases.
And I made it myself. Don't you think it's cute? I do think it's adorable.
Like in so many of these, and we just watched one recently with Wild at Heart, but with so many of these kind of murder on the run movies, the victims are often these grotesques, which I found particularly interesting in this movie.
Yeah.
Since, like I said, Leonard Castle did create, did fill in the blanks with these characters so much. Mm-hmm. He didn't have any info. So for the Janet Faye character, he said that cafeteria, she has a lot of money, but she takes them to a cafeteria.
I love it.
And she's so cheap about the pork chop.
That's so
that
good.
Was all created by him, and she's a big Catholic.
Now, you two, just help yourselves to whatever your hearts desire. It's my treat. My, $1.85 for a veal cutlet. I think I'll have a pork chop. It's a better buy. Pork chop, please. But have whatever you want, Charles. Don't let me influence you. You too, Martha.
I'll have the pork chop also, please.
Don't skimp on his potatoes like you did on mine. What'll you have, Martha, dear?
have the veal cutlet. I don't care for pork chops.
Veal cutlet for her. And go easy on the gravy. It looks starchy.
Then you've got the other victim who is singing. She's celebrating Lincoln's birthday with her child. Is this jingoistic woman who's singing the Star Spangled Banner in the tub. So there are these kind of grotesques, which in a movie like this almost feels like shorthand to put you on the side of the killers maybe a little bit. On the other hand, it also puts you in the killer's point of view because clearly these real life people had views and looked at the rest of humanity as depraved and silly and grotesque. And that's why they were able to do these murders. And both these real life characters had very sad lives. Martha experienced rapes at the hand of her brother.
Oh, right.
So I just think it's kind of a staple of this movie, but I can also type of movie, but I can also see why they made these decisions.
And also structure-wise, it really gets into a rhythm once we go through the marks of there's a bit of fun to, like, okay, it's episodic. You see one, that was enjoyable, and then you see a new one. Each one's different. Each one provides a new setting and a new tone to what our main characters are going to drop into, and it escalates and it changes, and it just provides a rhythm for the movie that I think really works for it in an effective way. Once we get to the killing, it is disarmingly effective in a way that I was not thinking that this movie would be able to pull off. When you shift into the victim's point of view, it's truly terrifying. And then he does this neat thing where he'll then shift into the killer's point of view, who they are also terrified in their own way. So there is this, the movie is sort of steeped in terror and realism that all seems to be sourced out of, the time and place in America and what's driving this, the desperation on all sides, whether it's, to find legitimacy in a mate or to get money to pay for this or that. I mean, bills are a big factor here. It's all really grounded in realistic motivations. And it all adds up to some real terror. And then the ultimate is the child's death, murder, which is, according to, the real life story, is it happens just the way it happens in the movie, and it's also brutal.
Completely brutal. Completely brutal. This movie, as even though there is this kind of gallows humor, it does not pull any punches when it comes to the murders of the victims that are so hard to watch. In one case, a pretty elongated scene, completely effective. And again, for a low budget movie, it really pulls it off. These murders. So this is the anti Bonnie and Clyde, which was kind of the mantra of Leonard Castle. He's like, I don't want to make he hated Bonnie and Clyde. I don't want to make a movie about sexy, good looking people, killing people. I want to make a movie that's warts and all.
Yeah.
And, this movie is, that could have been another title, Warts and All. This movie, you just shoves your face right in the warts.
It really does. Really does. Duncan, we're almost out of time.
We are almost out of time. I just want to, I don't want to be rushed here. I've got some more honeymoon.
I thought you were on a timetable here.
Well, I am, but hold on a second. I just want to say also for the ending, another deviation with the script was that Martha did not call them and give them up to the police. It was a neighbor.
Oh, a neighbor, yeah.
Something suspicious going on. And I really am excited to watch a little more of Shirley Stoller and Tony LoBianca's work. Tony is still with us.
Oh, yeah.
I've been watching some YouTube video interviews with him. Shirley Stoller, sadly, is not. I'll tell you the role that I really wish I had seen of hers is as Lolita's mother in Edward Albee's disastrous Broadway adaptation of Lolita, which I'd never even heard of. But she have some serious Shelley Winter vibes. But I'm just a big fan of this movie, as is Truffaut, Antonioni, and John Waters.
Is that right? Well, John Waters I can see, but Antonioni.
Truffaut says this is his favorite American film. And the movie made money. So again,
what?
This movie was
never heard of it.
This movie was a small hit. It was going to get dumped in the drive-in circuit, and then it got a couple good reviews, and I think they actually changed distributors, and it ended up making some money because not only was it getting some good reviews, so it got a little bit of the art house crowd, but it also got the exploitation crowd, and it was based on a true story that everybody was familiar with. No, this movie was a small hit, and again, just crazy that Leonard Castle never made another movie. When asked about it, Scorsese has no hard feelings about being a shit canned from the movie. For him, he just said that I'm not going to do my Scorsese impression, but he said the script was very long and I couldn't connect with the material. I just couldn't. Instead of making the film, I was trying to make a reputation, and I twisted and turned it in different ways stylistically. I tried to make it something that it shouldn't have been. Now the editor liked the footage Scorsese shot. He said there were some whip pans in the lake scene that maybe scared off the producers. Leonard Castle says they only had a few days and, you know, a certain amount of money, and Scorsese was like shooting a crushed beer can in the grass for half the day. But still, you watch the movie and it does have a little bit of that Scorsese distance from, I mean, distanced narratives about killers better than Scorsese. So, there does seem to be a little bit of his DNA.
I mean, as soon as I saw that that was the case, I it made total sense to me.
Well, the rubber's going to hit the road, Lex. Let's do it. It's been a chunky, big whopper episode. I have a stomach ache from all the Halloween fun I've been having. Psycho 2, clearly it blew your mind. I'm going to say it feels a little odd for me to be like, hey, Anthony Perkins just doing his Norman Bates thing really blew my mind. But the craftsmanship, the old school attention to detail, the strong script, my unbelievable Meg Tilly crush, I'm going to give Psycho 2 a real, I'm going to say it blew my mind. I'm going to say it blew my mind. It was a really classy time at the movies.
I'm really glad to hear that, because I felt like as soon as I saw Psycho 2, I thought, I think Duncan will like this, and it always feels good to hit the target, to hit a bullseye. I felt like that movie was made for you in many respects. As far as a horror movie goes.
My back is being scratched, so now what happens?
All right. Well, here we go into what I didn't. Frankly, I knew nothing about this movie. Duncan, I didn't know why I had to watch this movie. That's how I felt at the outset of this movie. I thought, what is this? Are you really going to make me fumble through some flimsy late 60s indie movie, black and white? I was getting kind of a early John Waters vibe at the start. Like I said, Romero, I've had some bad early Romero experiences. I thought, oh, this is not going to take off. The plane is not going to get off the ground. And boy, it soared. Let me tell you, once I really understood what this movie was, and it just picks up momentum, and it's all the things that we're talking about to the point that by the end I was truly terrorized by it. And after the fact, you know, I'm growing to understand what it's like for a movie to blow my mind. And one of the main characteristics of a movie that blows my mind is that it lingers with me for days afterwards. And it's not as if I'm actively thinking about it. It's that it drifts into my mind. It's that haunting. And that's what this movie is. And
blowback.
Absolutely, absolutely blew my mind.
Blowback. Well, I'm glad to hear that. Don't watch that one. Don't watch The Honeymoon Killers with your kids, everyone. It's not exactly a barrel of Halloween laughs. Everyone be careful out there doing your spooking and your knocking and your tricking and your treating. It's a crazy world. A lot of psychos out there.
That's right. Hey, after this, after Halloween is all over, you're going to hear from us again very soon with a bonus episode. And then we will be back to our usual programming. We got some good stuff in store. So
Lex, I had a great time. Have a happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween, Duncan. Did not blow your mind.